is a good day, God, because you are our God, and you are mighty and strong and powerful. We pray for everyone who's watching, who's listening. You know their needs, you know their hearts, you know their circumstances, Lord. And so this is not just a show today. We are just coming together in community so that we can support one another and that we can learn how to be more of a support and just show your hand to the world, Lord, by being your hands and feet. Thank you, God, for all these blessings. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, good morning and welcome to What's the Message? Yeah, it's me, Carmela Monk Crawford, editor of Message Magazine, the oldest, what we say, the longest running Black and Christian magazine in the country, could be on the continent, could be in the world, not sure about that, but we're still here, we're alive and kicking and have been for a long time because God has blessed us to still be here because I think he has a message to and for and through the Black experience here in the United States. And so we're here today exploring just another one of the important conversations that we need to have. And as you can see, I'm a little more formal today because I'm back in the office. Trust me, I don't want to be in the office. Like 81% of the people, Forbes just did a study. You might want to go and look it up. It's called Back to Work Blues. Nobody wants to be back in the office. Do our bosses know this? Do other people know this? I'm about to get fired just by saying this. Anyway, the whole idea is how can we bring the juggling, the efficiency that we had going on at home back in the office when we had to wear shoes? I don't know. Anyway, I'm on it. I'm trying to do what I can do. So I'm back in the office and we're doing our conversation today, a power-packed podcast today, because we got a lot of work to do, not just with Message, but within our communities. And so today I want to introduce and bring on for the first time a guest host, this marvelous young man that I had the opportunity to meet, Philip Warfield. I want you to know is our guest host today. He is a historian, a self-described historian, researching culture, race in United States history. And he's a blogger, a multimedia producer, and he's currently working on his doctorate at Howard University right now. Been there for, I guess this is his second year, going to his second year. Philip Warfield, welcome to What's the Message. Thank you for rolling with us today. How are you doing?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing okay. I am happy to just be here at home in DC. It's a little hot today though. So I'm staying inside and here I am wearing black because I don't know, but
you can wear a black turtleneck inside when you're inside all the time. I had to tell my son that all the time. He's got a full jogging suit on and everything. I'm like, man, I don't go outside. Well, that's where we are. Tell me, you are at Howard University right now. This has to be, I don't know, the absolute best time to be at Howard University. Talk to us about this. Look at all these people that you got coming on. You got Felicia Rashad, let's talk about that. And then Felicia Rashad, we got Hannah Nicole Jones, and now Ta-Nehisi Coates as well. Talk to us. What are you doing there?
Yeah, you know what? I'm excited. I'm hoping that I can take some of those undergraduate courses that they might be leading. Those were people that I've had on my list just to be inspired from for a while. I just made a note a year ago before any of these announcements that come along. And I was like, you know, if I could write like them, if I could just learn from them somehow, if I could just keep up with them, maybe I could get better myself. But here they are now on my campus, on the yard, as we say at Howard University. And I'm excited to hopefully learn at their feet.
Mm-hmm. Philip, you have an excellent radio voice and persona. What are you doing? Where are you from, first of all?
Oh man, the most tricky question in my life. Where am I from? I have lived now, if we count the District of Columbia as a state, which it might be in the next couple of years here, that would be about 10 different states and over 10 different cities. And I was born in Tucson, Arizona. It's the only one that I don't remember. So I've lived a little bit of everywhere. But as for what I do, you know, sometimes every now and then I do a little podcast called Phil's Philosophies, where I am looking for the spark, the thing that really inspires us to keep going and to find our own creative selves.
Mm-hmm. What are you studying and why?
Yeah, I study history. I'm a PhD student in history at Howard University. The why is because I love storytelling and I love stories and I love the depth that you can go through with just, you might think, okay, this happened in history, whatever. But it's about how that informs our present so that we can learn how to inform our future. The things that we do today really do affect us. And I'm not just talking about next year, but 5, 10, 15 years from now. Every day you're making history. And I love to watch that and journal that.
Now, one thing I know about you, you know, you've moved a lot and you've had a lot of experiences. Tell me, is it safe to say that you are at the intersection of race, culture, and religion and the generational divide?
Absolutely. You know what?
how has that been for you? It seems like you've had, if you follow the podcast, and I encourage everyone to go on and online and do, but you know, you have some very eye-opening experiences, especially with respect to race and religion. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm going to tell a very quick story about a recent thing that happened to me. I had gone back to my alma mater just to visit for a weekend. There was a Friday night service, and the first Black female was voted as student association president, the first Black female in 40 plus years. Mm-hmm. And I was just happened to be there, and I was celebrating with the rest of the crowd. But somebody decided to lie about me, put it on social media everywhere, and they claimed that I stood up and yelled Black power in the church at this Friday night service. And I was very confused because I didn't do that at all. I'm rather introverted. I'm not going to stand up and really do anything. But even then, what was the problem? Even if I had done that, why do people feel so afraid? And as someone who was born in between, if you will, the millennials and the Generation Z, those middle couple of years where nobody knows where you really belong, you're stuck in this, well, everybody is on social media talking about you. Meanwhile, you're saying, well, I just wanted to come by and relax and just not think about this. This is, you know, beyond me. These are students who are younger than me talking about this. I'm not a part of that. And just throughout my time, I guess, in my alma mater and in different things I'm involved in, there's always been this, Philip, where do you belong? And are you really saying this? Are you with us? Are you for us? You can't do anything that's too Black, if you will. All of that really comes down on me all the time, and it's a tricky balance.
A tricky balance. And here you are at, as Ta-Nehisi Coates calls, the Mecca at Howard University, studying history and with all of its implications. It's a very interesting time. Well, I just want you to jump in and roll with us today as we go through our discussions. You know, I got to take a moment here just to say we want to welcome our columnist, Philip, you know, thank you for being here. And you need to know Edward Woods III. I have my own people who know him. We have our own way of referring to him, but I'm going to call him Edward Woods today. Well, I don't know what you want me to call you, but he is so interesting because he's a veteran public servant with more than 20 years worth of experience, both communicating to and with different communities, helping people come together at the table. He is there working as a public servant in state and local governments in the state of Michigan. Currently, he is director of the Lansing Area Safety Council. Hopefully I have that correct. But for us, no, that's wrong. I'm looking at old information. So you need to make sure, because right now, the reason why he's here, number one, is that he is the president of the Conscience and Justice Council, as you see behind him. But he is also the Message Magazine social justice columnist. And we've been working together for years now. And he's been writing about redistricting for the last couple of issues. And just be honest, redistricting has my eyes glazing over. It's not as sexy a conversation as you're talking about voting, but why are we talking about redistricting? Talk to us, Edward Woods III, who I call Woody. Go ahead.
Thank you. Presently, I serve as the Communications and Outreach Director for the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. And so hopefully I can show evidence of growth to the great Philip, who's mother, you know, he's dating me, his mother and I are contemporaries. And it's just good to see him and good to see our next guest as well. Mm-hmm. You know, when I look at the three-legged stool of democracy, mm-hmm. I really look at voting. Mm-hmm. I look at the census and I look at redistricting. Everyone knows with the census, if you talk to the Census Bureau, every person that's not counted represents $18,000 a year and $180,000 over the course of 10 years if you're not counted in the census. People get that. It's sexy. It's clear. They mm-hmm. get it. They understand it. People understand the Voting Rights Act and all that took, the poll tax, the literacy tax, all these different taxes that we had just to get our right to vote. And it's not just for minorities, but also for women in the suffrage movement. People understand that and the difference one vote can make. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every 10 years after the census, you have redistricting. And there's a new movement to make redistricting more independent. In California and Arizona and Colorado and in Michigan, you have independent citizens redistricting commissions that have taken over the redistricting process. Usually redistricting is controlled by the legislator, the state legislature mm-hmm. that has the majority of the votes. And whether it's Republican or Democrat, it's always skewed to the party in power. Mm-hmm. So when I try to do redistricting in layman's terms, redistricting as we know it is politicians get to choose their voters. But the way redistricting should be is that voters should be able to choose their politicians.
Yeah, and yeah. So
when you look at redistricting, you're trying to also have to look at how the districts are set up. Are they set up politically to favor one party over another? Are they are they racial mm-hmm. in terms of, are they discriminatory for people of color? And then something that the NAACP has taken on this year is also prison gerrymandering, where we're moving people or counting people where they reside in prison, but not in their home community in terms of where they lived prior to going to prison.
And yeah, so, that part right there is so interesting to me. The idea that we have mass incarceration already because of the disparate treatment and access to justice for so many people, so overpopulated in terms of proportionate representation in our prison systems, people taken and put to different areas in rural areas far from home where they cannot vote, but the people in that area can count them for purposes of representation. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. And, you know, they can't vote. They don't have a vote. No one's asking them what their needs are or right. concerns, but yet they're counted in an area that probably they don't even know that they're even there, to be right. honest with you, the average elected official. And well, so, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do and communicate with redistricting is telling people it's about representation mm-hmm. and who cares about you and your interests. And so a lot of the things that I'm happy about redistricting reform mm-hmm. that is taking place in this country, obviously, when you look at redistricting, you have to follow the law.
Yeah.
when the law requires equal population. So in your congressional seat, which is when we talk about congressional, we're speaking obviously of the U.S. House of Representatives, because as we all know, the Senate elections are statewide, mm-hmm. but in the House of Representatives are done by congressional districts. So we're speaking about that. We're speaking about state house districts, and we're speaking about state Senate districts. And so the law says you have to follow equal population. So for example, in Michigan, since I'm familiar with that, we lost a congressional seat. We'll have 13 congressional seats. And the average number of people in each congressional district will be 775,200 people. 775,200 people. Mm-hmm. When we had 14 congressional seats, we had 710,000. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, how will the commission divvy up those congressional districts? And so you have to have equal population. You have to follow the Voting Rights Act and federal laws. The other thing is it has to be geographically contiguous. Mm-hmm. This is a ranked criteria. But then the third criteria is, and this is the only state in the country that has this as the third ranked criteria, is that it has to reflect the state's diversity and communities of interest.
Yeah.
And the communities of interest refer to historical characteristics, cultural characteristics, or economic interests. Those are very broad terms that the commission is working on defining, but people can self-identify their communities of interest so they're not split. You know, how you go to different cities and on the north side is of Martin Luther King may be one way, and the south side may be another way, or the railroad tracks. And therefore, the vote is diluted, because usually when they're doing that with minorities, they have two terms that they use.
Yeah.
They use the terms cracking and packing.
Mm-hmm.
Cracking is when you split the minority population up, and packing is when you put them together so you can have the least amount of representation as possible.
So
in terms of that.
Let me stop you right there, because you are obviously so knowledgeable about this, and I'm already getting lost.
I'm not doing a good job communicating.
So no, you are communicating. Carmella,
so I can communicate clearly. And Philip, please chime in for the sake of your mom, who I have much respect, to ensure clarity. Because if I can't explain it to Philip or Carmella, I'm in trouble.
Well, the thing is for me is that you're talking to us, you know, I get the voting and I get the other thing like this, but this sounds so far out of my reach as a citizen and an individual voter to affect this process. Am I right about that, or am I wrong about that?
Well, it really depends on how the process is set up in your state,
mm-hmm.
because every state does not have an independent citizens redistricting commission.
Mm-hmm.
The Brennan Center has they're saying all eyes are on Michigan to see how it will work, because if it works, you know how we say on the internet, it can go virtual.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the real world, this could go viral, and mm-hmm. other states may adopt it. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania is talking about redistricting right now. Texas is talking about, independent commissions for redistricting. So you want to first and foremost, if I were you, mm-hmm. I would go to the National Council of State Legislatures and see how is redistricting done in my community.
Mm-hmm.
Another good site is the Brennan Center for Justice. But the National Council of State Legislators has been working on this. They have a thorough breakdown state by state in terms of who is in charge of the redistricting process. And then once you identify who's in charge, I would encourage your listening audience to contact the people in charge, so whether it's a commission, whether it's a legislator, whether it's a hybrid, and speak to the issues. Identify if they're going to have public hearings so you can recruit people in your community to identify what are the issues of the community, how have they been marginalized in the past, if there's cracking or packing going on, so that their vote is not diluted.
Mm-hmm.
The whole concept, if you have, you know, great redistricting, is you have more competitive races. When you have more competitive races, you have people who actually represent their constituency versus representing their party.
Mm-hmm.
A case in point, if you haven't seen the documentary Slay the Dragon, mm-hmm. it's on YouTube. It talks about, in Michigan in particularly, how gerrymandering may have been an impact on why there were so many people willing to vote for the emergency manager law. You know, the emergency manager law stripped the local council of their power. It basically stripped the residents of Flint from being able to say who they would like to represent them, because the emergency manager basically had absolute power. Yeah. And as a result, you know what happened with regards to the water and lack of vegetation, the resulting effects. There, there is a perspective or a theory that would suggest that if there wasn't gerrymandering, and there was, there would be more concern about the people of Flint versus more concern about following the party.
The party.
That's why we really want to look at gerrymandering, so that we can make sure that the people that represent us are actually representing our interests and doing what's best for the community more than doing what's best for the party. And I think that's something, you know, I hope I explained kind of clearly in terms of grasping that concept, because at the end of the day, we all want fair representation and we all want competitive races, because if you have competitive races, you can be rest assured that the person elected to represent you will be in contact with you, because they understand, going back to the three-legged stool of democracy, that every vote counts. And as you know, Carmela, our theme last year was everyone counts, everyone matters.
Yeah. Philip, you were going to say something. I saw you.
Yeah. So I want to localize this a little bit for somebody who lives in the District of Columbia, where representation is just a different story here. I want to ask you, for somebody who doesn't have, I believe, representation in the Senate, I could be wrong, it could be House of Representatives, either way, what does all of this discussion mean for someone who lives in D.C.?
Well, D.C. needs statehood.
Yeah.
And so that, unfortunately, is not a redistricting matter. It needs statehood so that it can have, you know, adequate representation in terms of in the Senate. I mean, I know you have a representative or a delegate, as they say, in D.C., but D.C. really needs full statehood. And unfortunately, that is not a redistricting matter. It's a legislative matter that is long overdue. And I don't know if it will happen anytime soon, because let's face it, it's not about representation. It's about politics and power and what that would do to the balance of power by giving D.C. an actual a seat at the table. I mean, it's very well documented. The population of D.C. is larger than some states, but yet they have representation and D.C. does not. And so, unfortunately, redistricting cannot solve that, but we can raise our voice, Philip. And if you want some help, I'd be more than happy to identify some folk for you and Carmela to interview about the importance of D.C. statehood and why it needed to happen yesterday. No more promises for tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, why is this conversation, number one, I was on the NAACP we had a long day of continuing legal education the other day. Very interesting on the same issue. We learned about both disenfranchisement and dilution. And what you're talking about with redistricting is to talk about dilution of the vote. Isn't that right? That means
That's correct.
Can we, if we have different voices or different bodies, how can we break that up so their impact and their effect on the vote is not as great? And with disenfranchisement, how can we make it so that, and I'm not sure that anybody is consciously saying it like that, but making sure that some of these voters are not voting. So back in the day when they would do the, you know, how many bubbles are in a bar of soap, today many people equate making sure you have the right kind of ID when you show up at the polls to another level of disenfranchisement or potential disenfranchisement, right? Well, let me ask you. Go ahead.
You're dead on. I mean, when you're looking at disenfranchisement, you're really looking at voting. That's how I like to make a real clear direction, or clear as I don't want to say as mud, but as clear as water. And we want to say clean water. Mm-hmm. And then when you're looking at dilution of the vote, you're really looking at redistricting. And then when you're looking at disinvestment into our communities, you're really looking at the census. And so I just really want to go back to that three-legged stool of democracy, you know, for clarity so that people can understand and participate equally in all of them, because all of them are important to ensure that our voices are heard.
Okay. In the last couple of minutes that we are together, when I'm hearing you talking, I'm seeing this issue. You talk about three-legged stool. I'm looking at a ball of tangled yarn when you talk about everything that's going on here. And so there's two, if I'm going to continue this sort of analogy, how do you pull out the thread that says, you know, this is not racial? You know, we have Black communities saying, you know, you are diluting our vote. And how do you answer that when people say, well, this is just partisan, you know, Republicans and Democrats, and this is what we're worried, you know, we're concerned about. This is not, you know, the fact that this affects Black and brown communities one way is just a byproduct of what we're doing on a partisan level. How do you address that?
Well, I would actually, you know, cite examples in terms of how redistricting has resulted in racial gerrymandering, how redistricting has resulted in partisan gerrymandering. And you can see it when you have states that say, well, how in the world, this is what they tell us in Michigan, can a state overwhelmingly vote Democrat, but yet have less seats in the Senate and less seats, you know, in the Senate, and with such a huge disparity? You know, how does that happen? You know, how were the maps drawn to allow that? And these are questions that people ask and have. And then you have to really go back and look at the maps. You know, do you see like a little ear canal? you know, usually when they talk about compactness is they said it should be like a square or a circle. You know, when it talks about what the ideal shape should look like when it comes to maps. And you can see in different maps where people are alleging the allegations of gerrymandering, where you see a sliver and one, you know, going all the way up. You're like, well, how does this sliver is in this district, but yet this other thing is right here? How does that happen? And you got to start asking yourselves the questions, you know, where we have these gerrymandering of districts across the country, you know, how are they doing? Where, and look at the layers. When you look at people of color, when you look at interest, when you look at the disparities in the Senate, disparities in the House at the state legislative level, the disparities in the congressional representation, along with the voting patterns, you can see, you know, some of these issues.
Okay, let me stop you right there.
I would suggest that you would look at, it's a nonpartisan, but the Brennan Center for Justice really has some great studies. It identifies, you know, specific areas and why they've been successful in winning their court cases for redistricting. You will also understand why the Brennan Center has called for reform and saying that state legislative lines should be drawn by independent citizens, redistricting commission, and not politicians.
Last question.
It really lays the case. And I know we don't have a lot of time, but I wanted to give a resource.
Right. I'm going to ask you this last question very quickly. Why do I care about this as a Christian? People are going to say, well, you know, you're really getting into the weeds on partisan issues, on political issues. Why do I care about this as a Christian?
Well, from a Christian, you want to make sure that your community has the best representation possible. You know, I mean, we talk about the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We talk about speaking up for the rights of the poor and the needy. We talk about these things. And unfortunately, because of a lack of fair representation, because votes have been diluted, or in some cases, votes have been disenfranchised, we ought to care that our community has the best representation possible to address their needs. This is not a political issue. This is a representation issue and ensuring that all voices are heard, because we are all one, created in the image and likeness of God.
All right.
And so if we care about humanity, we will also care about fair representation so that everyone can be represented fairly, regardless of their income, regardless of their color, regardless of their gender, and regardless of their religion. We're just doing it as Christians because this is in the best interest of others.
Thank you. Thank you. That's, hey, you hit it. I understood you. Okay. I'm just letting you know, I understood you. It's just, it's one of those things that we don't talk about on a daily basis, and it doesn't have the star power when you talk about redistricting as some of the other things. Look, you and I, we've been working on a project, and I want you to tell people about that really quick as we end this segment.
What sure. Message Magazine and the Conscience and Justice Council are really pleased to announce for 2022 mm-hmm. that we'll be having a morning devotional speaking on conscious issues, justice issues, prophecy issues, the gospel, mm-hmm. Psalms, discipleship, and how it all intertwines to conscience and justice. I really do believe that the Public Affairs and Religious Liberty Ministry is the ministry that will hasten the second coming of Christ. Mm. And if we can't figure out how to get along as brothers and sisters in Christ, not just in churches, but also in relating and identifying to the community of who we are and whose we are, mm-hmm. then we're not going to be able to show a true reflection of Christ. If you look at the parables of Christ, the majority of the parables of Christ did not happen in the church. They happen in the community. Mm-hmm. The Good Samaritan happened in the community. And so when we think about what God has done and what he is doing, we need to revolutionize how we do church and be concerned about the issues that are impacting the community around our churches. So all instead right. of being commuters where we go in and out, we mm-hmm. reestablish who we were. When we first got started as regional conferences in the 1940s, about 80 years ago. And deliberate, sorry, I'm flowing. bring me in. More intentional and deliberate about meeting the needs of our community. Yeah. And it wasn't about getting people on the membership rolls. It was about taking care of their physical, emotional, and spiritual needs following Christ's method of evangelism as outlined in the gospel. Thank you so much, Carmela, for my borrowed time. God bless you. God bless you, Philip. And I look forward to this next stellar guest coming on after me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today and for helping us understand. And that's, you know, I want to just say to everyone, when you get the magazine and you see, you got to look up our guest, Edward Woods' column, because each time he is talking about these issues right there, because you and I sort of stand in the stream of what's happening, and you see the overall effects, not just in the community, but what's happening, I guess, from a spiritual point of view. And so thank you so much for joining us today, and we appreciate it. Hey, Philip, is there anything you wanted to say as we close that part out? What do you think? Anything?
Yeah, in fact, you've just identified so many places where it looks like, as you've said before, that things like these are not as sexy, and we really need to spend some time learning about them. So I've already identified some gaps in my political knowledge, and I want to say thank you, because there's still a lot to learn, even for this second year PhD student. Thanks for being on today.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Dr. Phil, I want to learn from you, because there's more than one original Dr. Phil. And so I look forward to gleaning from you. I'm having you be a part of our conscience and justice discussions. And I'm gleaning your input, gleaning from your insights as we make it a better world generation by generation and hastening the second coming of Christ. So God bless you and much success in your program.
Thank you so much. Hey, listen, okay, I'm running behind, and I need you to know right now, we've got a stellar guest this morning in the person of Ms. Shailene Hardy, who just, you know, we found out today, she's going to be probably one of the family very soon. So I hope you don't mind that you're stuck with us now, Shailene Hardy. Shailene Hardy, you have to know, currently serves as the national director of the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's Black Campus Ministry. What does that mean? Over 10 years of ministry in the Great Lakes East region, she played a key role in expanding BCM, that's the Black Christian Ministry, student participation from around 200 to well over 600, co-founding GLE's BCM Student Conference Ignite in 2010, Shailene helped develop that conference from 40 participants into the nation's largest Black Campus Ministry Student Conference with more than 400 participants. That's a big feat right there, to, first of all, to get young people to come around and want to be a part of this. She also has worked to grow BCM staff from in GLE from 2 Black staff to 15 today. They've got a whole crew working to serve her constituency. Before her current role, Shaylin served as the Associate National Director of BCM. We just want to welcome you today. And listen, if you're watching right now, I need you to go and you're passing through or you're pausing. I want you to share this with everyone, because this young lady right here is working on campuses across the United States to help young people connect with Christ. Is that right? Is that a way to sum it up? Tell me, Shaylin.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I think one of the ways that we talk about it is college is really a critical time in young people's life. They're deciding who they're going to be, what they're going to be about, and the trajectory that they're going to be on. And oftentimes those decisions are made when they're the most distant from their families and their spiritual communities. Mm-hmm. So we actually think it's vitally important to have somebody to walk with them through that period. And so we are on college campus to create space for Black students to feel welcome, to ask questions of the faith, and help to mature in their own faith experience. For many students, they kind of grow up in the church, mm-hmm. and they get off into college and they have to decide if it's something that they want to own on their own or leave behind. And so we want to help students in that process.
Mm-hmm. How many colleges, college campuses are you on?
So InterVarsity is on around 700 campuses. BCM has outreaches on about specific focus ones, like chapters, on about 60, but we also have small groups on some of those larger fellowships as well.
That's a big job. Philip, I'm sorry, you saying something.
So as far as I know, as far as my little research that I've done about you as well, you didn't start off and go to college and think, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And so I'm always thinking about purpose. And I want to ask you about how you got here. Because as far as I read, you came in with a volleyball scholarship to a school and then suddenly things changed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So I'm a twin. So when I tell my story, oftentimes I'll say we, but I mean, like, we do a lot of things together. So I just want to name that up front. So came into college as a two-sport athlete, played volleyball and basketball. And that was basically my world, really. We had our academic support services. We had a cafeteria that we ate in. And I was walking on campus one day. Oh, so, you know, raised in the church, BTU, Sunday school, choir, drill team, all that. But kind of started getting distant in my faith when I was a college student. So my mom will call every now and then and be like, hey, I haven't seen y'all in church. What's going on? That kind of thing. And so I was walking on campus one day and I saw the sign for a group called Collegiate Black and Christian, which is BCM's outreach at Western Michigan. And I remember thinking, like, I'm all those things. Like, I should go check out this organization on campus. Yeah. And so I went, and it was in the context of that community I really learned how to dig in and to study scripture and ways in, that allowed scripture to just come alive to me. And then we actually talked about what does it mean to really give your life, your academics, your dating relationship, like what does it mean to make God Lord of all? Mm-hmm. And so I was seeing the transformation that was happening in my life, but I also was seeing that transformation in, you know, friends on campus, and I was recruiting athletes to join. So my sister and I started an athletes Bible study from that. And I was just seeing what God was doing on campus. And mm-hmm. so I ended up going to this national student conference that InterVarsity holds. And I had one of those moments where I was like, oh, my understanding was that something like this exists for all Black students on all campuses. Mm-hmm. And so as I was talking to students at this conference, they were like, no, like, it's just me. You know, I'm the only person on campus. There is no fellowship. There is nothing for me to be connected to where I can be authentically Black and also grow in my faith. And so I had a time with the Lord, and I was like, this is not right, Lord. You need to do something about this. Like, Black students have space to encounter God on college campuses where they don't have to compromise who they are and they don't have to assimilate. And so I had this like wrestling with the Lord, like, you need to do something about this. And you know, when you say stuff like that, you just got to be careful, because he often recruits you to be the answer to those problems. And that's kind of how
you need to do something about this. That's what happened, huh? Mm-hmm. Tell me, Well, tell us, what does it look like if you are on a campus and you've got Black Christian ministry on the campus? What is it, like a program or some kind of, you said fellowship. What is it? What is it made of?
Yeah, so we, our fellowships hold lots of different things. So one would be small groups. So we'd have different opportunities for students to study scripture and community in different places around the campus. We like to try to do that locationally, so they're easy for students to access, but also kind of in like the different specializations. So it might be, you know, we might have a Black Greek one for Greek students who want to wrestle with like some of the struggles that they face uniquely in that community, or athletes or artists. So we really want to say like, help students engage with questions of faith from their current context. We also do discipleship. And so meeting with students one-on-one or meeting with students in a small group to talk about, you know, to read a book together, to talk about a career path that they want to go on. We also do kind of evangelistic outreaches. One of the things that we do is called a proxy station. And so they're like interactive art displays where we have conversations about faith with students who come up. And so the proxy station is very interesting. When we first started doing it, people would walk up because they were visually attracted to it. And I think that that's very big for Generation Z, like something that like pulls their imagination. Mm-hmm. So there's one time like we you know, let them know who we are. We're saying, tell them we're having spiritual conversation. It was one time on campus while I was working and we were doing one of these proxy stations, and there's like students waiting in line to talk to us. And I'm like, there's a line of students who are waiting to talk to us about questions of faith. It just was very interesting. So we train students in how to share their faith and make it their own. And then we do that on campus as well. And then also just like social activities, ways for students to feel connected, to feel like they belong, to feel like they are part of something bigger on campus. And so that's kind of the campus side of it. And then we also host conferences. So we'll do like regional Black student conferences. There's also area and regional conferences where all students come. So we are Black Campus Ministries, but we're part of the InterVarsity family. So that includes our multi-ethnic fellowships, our Asian American, Latino, Native ministries as well.
This is amazing. The scope of the ministry that you're involved in. I saw another interview where you were talking about sort of a prayer event, and that the response sort of surprised you. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so we typically, as you heard, do in-person conferences. And so we have 14 Black student conferences that we host across the country. But because of the pandemic, we were like, we don't want to risk the health of anybody or the community. So we canceled all of them. And so we had the idea of like, let's just do a virtual conference and, you know, see what happens. And so we had over 500-ish people in attendance. And so we had a intercession and prayer team set up. We designed a virtual prayer room, and we thought that we had enough people prepared to pray for the students, and we did not. And so what happened is like the prayer coordinator calls me and she's like, Shaylin, we are overwhelmed. Like, we need help. So I'm like texting other staff people, recruiting people to jump on and pray for students. I jump on to pray for students. Mm-hmm. And the time I actually got on the call, because I was recruiting people, was probably like 30 minutes after our session had ended. And students were still in the prayer room waiting to be prayed for. And so the way that it was set up, it was like, you know, while you're here, we had worship music playing in the background, you know, journal. Listen for what the Lord might be saying to you to prepare for prayer. But I think that people always typecast this generation as like, not hungry for the Lord or lukewarm or only about their own things. And I was like, that was a moment where I was like, no, these students are hungry to connect to God. They want that interaction. We just need to be people who are creating spaces for them to be able to encounter the Lord. Like, they were willing to wait over 30 minutes for a virtual prayer line. That shows the hunger that exists within this generation.
So I'm wondering, actually, since you have, this is BCM, and even though you're doing a lot of things that you mentioned earlier, Asian groups and Hispanic groups, so HSIs, PWIs, that kind of thing, what are some of the difficulties that you have? Because sometimes when you label something Black, people get really afraid, even though we're talking about, you know, a great Christian event and group of people. So how do you navigate some of those particulars?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do get challenged. And there are people who are like, that's unbiblical. Mm. And I think that one of the things that, like, I am convinced, like, we have a both and perspective. We believe that ethnic identity development is essential. We also believe in multi-ethnic unity. And so we believe we have ethnic specific chapters or focus chapters. We also have multi-ethnic fellowships. So in our focus chapters, we are the front door that students walk in is ethnic identity development. So in a BCM chapter, we're going to talk about, we might talk about money. Mm-hmm. So we might talk about how, as people of faith, we should handle money, but we also might talk about some of the particular hangups the Black community has, or some of the opportunities the Black community. So it's like we are experiencing, we are having conversation from a cultural context as we ask questions of the faith. But we also need the multi-ethnic unity component. And so we need to make sure that all of our fellowships are going to our multi-ethnic conferences. At Michigan State, we have 4 different chapters. We had a Latino fellowship, we had a Black Campus Ministries, we had Asian American fellowship, and we had a multi-ethnic fellowship. Now, none of these are as exclusive. Like, a white student can join a BCM chapter if they want to. Mm-hmm. It is a culturally Black expression of Christianity. So if that's what you want to experience, that's cool. And so, like, but our chapters operated independently, but mm-hmm. we did joint things. We did joint outreaches on campus. We did joint fellowships, movie nights, game nights. And so we think that unity and multi-ethnicity in the body of Christ is essential. But I think oftentimes what happens in those spaces is it's an assimilation into whiteness. Mm-hmm. So we believe, like, if you have a multi-ethnic fellowship, that's great. Like, you're strong on the multi-ethnic inclusion, like the unity side of it, but you need to help your people identify what gifts and what challenges they have in their own ethnic identity as well. And so I think that, like, we do get challenged in that, but I also ask the question, how are your ministries doing at reaching Black people?
Mm.
Because the reality is most of them are not. So at Michigan State, like I said, that was my context. There are over 55 campus ministries. Mm-hmm. They're probably, when I got on campus, there were one that had Blacks, like a decent number of Black students. Mm-hmm. One of the largest had like 400 people and had like 4 Black people. And so the pushback of this isn't right, this isn't biblical, we believe it is, and we have to kind of explain that. But my question is, what about my people?
Yeah, yeah.
Who are gonna reach the Black students on campus? Your strategy is not. So are you saying that we should wait 10 to 15 years until you finally decided that there's a strategy that you want to try to reach Black students?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to those generations of students now? What happens when they go back into their communities and they decide to walk away from the faith? They don't have a strong relationship with the Lord. And so, again, I think that we have a biblical foundation for the way that we do things, but even the practical application of we are doing this so that Black Christians, as they step on campus, they grow in their faith and they're stronger when they leave. They go into church communities that they can be a part of impacting the church house, but also the communities they're called to and the families that they're going to as well.
You mentioned, you know, Philip's question makes me think about Gen Z, and you're right, Gen Z, millennials on down, like Philip, you said you're sort of in that nether world there, and then to Gen Z, you know, they do have the reputation of being not as traditionally religious, not as Christian and all that. And so you identify for us, I guess, you put your finger on the fact that, first of all, there's interest and there is a level of participation that we may be surprised about. I sure would like to hear about sort of the challenges to the faith of a Black Gen Z right now. Mm-hmm. What are those things that they're wrestling with?
Yeah, I think one thing that we're seeing is students asking the question, based on what I see,
mm-hmm.
And based off of the people who claim the name of Jesus, mm-hmm. is that really consistent with his message? And if it's so, is it worthy to be followed? Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's, you know, there is kind of a popular term that people are talking about, like kind of like a deconstructing of faith. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's happening, but I think that sometimes it's happening in a place where there's not people to walk through them in the process. And so because they're trying to throw away the problematic parts of the faith that have been on display, they end up just throwing away the whole thing, where there's like, there are parts of it that are good. There's parts of it that's right. Like the ways that white supremacy and Christianity have been intertwined. Yeah. Throw that away, take that off, throw it in the trash, but don't take the whole gospel and throw it away with it. And so I think one of the questions that Generation Z is asking is based off of even what media is showing as like, who has the voice of the Christian community? They're asking, is that really consistent with what the gospel really is? And I think also part of it is the question of, is the gospel good? I think Generation Z is very, very big on inclusion. They want everyone to feel welcome. They want to feel like they are trustworthy to all of these different people. And there's ways in which the faith can be communicated in ways that feels very down-putting and exclusionary. And so it's like, how is the gospel good news? And what does Jesus have to say about racial injustice? What does Jesus have to say about mental health? And mental health is also significant in this generation as well. We've never seen a generation statistically that has as many diagnosable mental health concerns, but also even undiagnosed mental health concerns. And that was before the pandemic. And yeah. So there's some ways in which they're asking questions about, you know, some of the mental health issues that they're facing as well.
Wow. How do we do a better job? And, you know, I'm saying this as a person who has some Gen Zs in my home. How do we do a better job? You know, you say you live in a community and maybe you live in a community near an HBCU, or maybe, you know, you live near a campus. Is there something that, you know, families or, you know, different faith communities can do to support better? Because you said that people are going through this process, this deconstruction, or they're shouldering the load of, I guess, mental health implications, all the while so many of these other things are being redefined. How is a way that we can come alongside and support them in that journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's absolutely significant. I think that one is trying to find people of peace. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it is significant to see if there's somebody on campus that you already have a connection with. Maybe there's a student, maybe there's a professor or a counselor, and letting them know like, hey, our family is interested in being present for a student. If there's a student that you meet, comes to your office hours, who's really struggling or seems like they need like a family connection, like we'd be happy to host them for dinners. Mm-hmm. I think that's a practical way of just showing them that there's somebody in their corner. And then I think that as trust is built, they mm-hmm. will kind of share more of their story and share more of their life with you. But I think that authenticity is super, super huge. Mm-hmm. In Generation Z. And so I think part of it is like building trust to let them know that you are there and you can be a person. And I think that there are just ways where, like, if you're in that college space, sometimes there's things that you can go and talk about with your parents, but sometimes you're wrestling for that independence. Like, who do I go to with this thing? And so I think having that space. And so one of the things that I've been trying to, toy around with our church is like, can we actually start a program where we're training folks in the congregation to be able to have a student that they are intentionally praying for, that they invite over for dinner, that they are just being the people there while they're away at college. I think that the reality is like for most people outside of HBCUs, mm-hmm. College campuses, the accessibility Black students on most PWI campuses have to other Black folks outside of the campus is small. Okay. There are no Black churches in close proximity because of wealth. Like white churches and people brought all the property around. So in most places, you're driving or taking a bus 10 to 15 minutes to find the Black community. And so that is, I think, one of the big needs that we see on campuses. And I think that that's a unique space that churches and people of faith can play in the community. I think for individual families, it might be a little bit more difficult. And that's why I say, like, work through a gatekeeper, because you don't kind of just want to show up on campus and like, hey, like, who wants to, like, I'll take you to dinner.
Who wants to go to dinner?
Although, if you offer dinner, you still might have some takers. Yeah. But I do think working through a gatekeeper, but I think for a congregation, I think that you could develop relationships. You could go to like a student fair. You could meet one or two key students. And those are the people who unlocked more networks to you in the rest of the campus.
Right, right. Man, this is so, so interesting. I'm, you know, like I said, you're going to be stuck with us for a long time, Shaylin. It's just so great to meet you. And I believe that many of us can, who are so interested in the experience of our Gen Zs and our younger millennials on the younger side as well, we want to support them. This has to be such a tough time with the pandemic, with so many things with racial implications right now. How is your level of participation at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we're trying to figure that out. I think, you know, we have a clear vision of where we were pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think we're trying to like survey of like, how many students are we working with? How much are we restarting? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that, quite honestly, we have a very clear picture of that yet. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I can't actually give as clear of an answer as I would like to.
Yeah, we got to do some work together, and I would love it. So how can people connect with you if you would like them to connect with you, maybe on social media, or how can they find a way so that they can know where there may be a BCM near them or something like that?
Absolutely. So we are on Facebook and Instagram at Black Campus Ministries. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to kind of get a glimpse of some of the work that we do. If you want to check out our website, it's bcm.intervarsity.org. Mm-hmm. And, I'm terrible at social media. It's not something that I do a lot, but if you want to contact me directly, it's shaylin.hardy@intervarsity.org. And so, on our website, you can basically find out how to, where our chapters are located. But also, if you connect with us, we actually have been developing resources to help people start new chapters. So let's say that you have a student who's graduating and going to a place that there is no ministry, or the ministry doesn't feel like a fit. We can actually help them start a ministry on campus, or help them figure out how to get spiritual community.
Do you care what the denomination is?
Nope, we are interdenominational. And mm-hmm. so we encourage our students strongly to be connected to church communities. Okay. We want our students to be involved in churches while they're in school, because we think it's a natural transition for when they graduate as well. So mm-hmm. it's basically, we feel like our mission field, so to speak, is the college campus. And so we want to help students think critically about how to be good stewards of their time in college. But we also want them to connect to broader faith communities. And so that's a place where they can really connect with their denominational roots if they choose to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just want to say thank you to Shaylin Hardy for joining us. Man, this young lady is so full of energy and wisdom. As the National Director of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship Black Campus Ministry, or BCM, she's got a lot of weight on her shoulders. And so we just stand with you. And I hope that we can come alongside to, I guess, share in that load, maybe doing what we're saying to be able to help folks. And we've had a great time talking to Edward Woods III. Redistricting is not the most exciting headline, yet it is vital and crucial that we say something right now, as we've learned this week. When those maps are drawn and certain communities are cut, or their vote and their voice is diluted, it's going to be hard to get that voice and that advocacy back for those communities. So now's the time to contact, first of all, read up on it so that you understand what's happening, but also now's the time to contact your congressional representative and your state and local offices. As Edward Woods III told us, go ahead and look it up. Find out how we can jump in and be a part of this process before it's too late. That's your duty as a Christian. That's part of the golden rule, making sure people have access. As always, We're here at Message Magazine. We've got a wealth of information and goodness to share alongside the community. You're watching. I want you to share this with other people that you know. Remember, we're in a campaign. MessageMagazine.com is where you can go to subscribe both to our digital issue and our print issue. The print issue can go into the prison where you cannot right now, especially because of the pandemic and COVID. We just got word this past week from our Bible study writer, Mr. Rashad Burden, who will be on the podcast in a couple of weeks, who says he still gets, and he does, because he puts his number in the magazine. And he says, look, if you have a hard time going through this, what we're studying right now, and you need somebody to pray for you, go ahead, call me. And sure enough, people are calling him. He told me this week, he's got people calling and saying, I just called for my prayer. Nothing being said, nothing has to be shared. Just we want to lift you up and come alongside. So, hey, that's where we are, messagemagazine.com. You can follow us if you don't on Facebook and on YouTube. If you're watching this, you probably already know that at Message Magazine, Facebook and YouTube. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Please like us and follow us whenever you see us at Message 1898. In the meantime, we'll be back next week for another important and critical conversation that I think really builds up the community, and just helps us all around. Thanks a lot for joining us. Same time next week, different conversation. Take care. Bye-bye.